work you done on alkylation?
Yeah, the work we did on alkylation DNA and protein helped get me immersed in biochemistry and got me acquainted with a lot of biochemists. And so that helped a great deal in getting organized for this kind of work.
Before we get off to other aspects of your career, I wanted to ask you just a few more questions about physical organic chemistry.
Sure.
And what would you call a major characteristics of physical organic chemistry? I think what I'm trying to get at is some kind of definition of what it is, what it was. I'll ask you in just a few minutes where you think it's headed, but let's say the major characteristics.
Well, I guess a very simple-minded way of putting it would be that a chemist is interested in what happens, and a physical organic chemist is interested in why and how it happens. That's a very simple-minded way of putting it, but I think that's the distinguishing characteristic between a traditional approach to organic chemistry, which is, what can I do?
Yeah.
If I mix A and B, what do I get?
Yeah.
A physical organic chemist wants to know what the intermediates are, how it goes, and why, and what factors influence it. I think the other is very important. But this is important for both synthetics, and that's the effective structure on the activity.
Yeah.
Even a synthetic chemist has to know that. But that's certainly a characteristic feature of physical organic chemistry, to try to understand the nature of the structure, effective structure of the activity. An organic, traditional organic chemistry could have a kind of a part of its bones without really knowing why.
Yeah. Do you think, in fact, that organic chemistry has, now with the sort of advent of physical organic chemistry, has undergone some kind of a change?
Well, I don't think there's any question about it. The organic chemist today is a very, very rare bird if he doesn't think about mechanisms of reaction, even the most synthetic.
Yeah. I mean, these are my feelings. I just want, I feel more secure when people say that's the way they feel.
No question.
Where do you think physical organic chemistry is headed? Phil Skell said to me a year or two ago, physical organic chemistry is dead. The only thing physical organic chemists do now is add another decimal point to, or another decimal, a figure after the decimal point on already well-known numbers and things of that sort. I'm not sure I agree with that, but I just wonder if you give any thought.
No, I don't think I agree with that. There's still some reactions that I don't think I know anything about that are fascinating, and as long as they're sitting there unexplained, they offer a challenge to a physical organic chemist. I could cite one example, and it's norbornene. If you add HSCN to norbornene, you get an almost instantaneous addition with no rearrangement. Whereas every other HX that instantly rearranges it. Well, you know, you can say it just goes by a four-center addition reaction and wave your arms at it, but you know, I don't think anybody knows or has done work that has elucidated that mechanism. I do agree that an awful lot of academic research has gotten to be what I call crossword puzzle type, which maybe is putting another decimal point on the end of what you already know,
yeah,
or solving a very clever kind of problem that has absolutely no possibility of being a great,
yeah,
significance to anybody except the guy that did it.
Yeah.
But I think that's probably true of any field of chemistry that's similar to that kind of,
yeah,
stuff.
What about
it? Certainly got to be true that the emphasis on practical results led to a decrease in support for physical organics, by NSF, for example. So physical organic chemistry came with hard times because they weren't getting financial support. I don't think that necessarily equates to meaning that there isn't anything left interesting to do.
What about the orientation that you yourself took, that is working more in biological problems? I mean, I assume that you felt there was a role for you there, and
yes, and there still probably is a fairly good role. I think, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in that area that we don't understand yet. Somebody with a good background in physical organic chemistry, I think, is going to be bound to be able to make important contributions to biochemistry. Well, I certainly don't think it's all been done, and it's a dead subject by any means. I think even if an awful lot of the fundamentals have been worked out, that doesn't mean that people won't forevermore be using those principles in the way they approach chemical problems, wherever they are, biochemistry, solar energy, whatever the problem is. A fundamental part of it is going to be physical organic chemistry. Interaction of molecules in a solid state is an area which we don't understand too well yet. There's a lot of exciting stuff that can be done in solid state. I mean, we know dilute solutions, that's where it's easy to study and understand the behavior of molecules. But how they behave en masse is a lot of them. Very important. People really know about what the catalytic center is. Incidentally, that was another one of my first that has been totally ignored. I was the first one to propose the mechanism of Liebig catalysis, but it is now accepted as a basic mechanism. I published that in, the only guy I know that acknowledges is Nada. But everybody else always ascribes that mechanism to somebody else. And, when we were doing our work on the stereochemistry of epoxide polymerization, coordination catalyst, that immediately seemed to me as a mechanism that we could prove very neatly, much more evidence for epoxide polymerization, but we had optically active monomers to work with, get a lot more handle, applied exactly to the Ziegler system, and we postulated a two-metal center with coordination of the olefin and the rearrangement. And everybody accepts that as a mechanism, but I don't think anybody mentions that I was the first one to propose it.
Yeah. That's interesting. I was going over the list of your papers, and as well as looking at some of those other papers, I said, my gosh, you know, you were sort of always at the forefront of a number of important problems, and strange question to ask, but did you consciously sit down and say, gee, I wonder what's important this year, or and maybe we should turn our attention to that, or do I think this is going to be a significant a problem, or did you just automatically fall into
it was probably not highly conscious, but certainly not entirely unconscious either. I mean, the epoxide stuff, for example. I got interested in the epoxide polymerization because of the idea I had that the polypropylene oxide would make a good rubber. That idea came to me when I was chairing the National Research Council meeting on low-temperature rubber. I chaired two meetings on rubber and NRC. One was a 4 or 5 day conference on how to design and develop better rubbers for low temperature use, and another one about a year or two later on rubbers for high temperature use. I was chairing the paper. The one on low temperature rubber was really a very interesting conference. What we decided to do was to get together about 20 people, about half from universities and half from fundamental scientists from industry, to talk about the basic principles of what makes a rubber behave the way it is, and how could you design compounds that have a better chance of being successful? And as a result of those discussions, it became clear to me that we needed a chain with a high degree of flexibility and a low Van der Waals interaction between chains. And all clicked with me to mean an ether. An ether has much lower barrier to rotation than a carbon-carbon bond, has very low Van der Waals interaction, and so, you know, out of that meeting, it occurred to me that the best one very good rubber for low temperature would be a polyether chain. It was amorphous, it had to be amorphous, and it crystallized. It was a regular order, so I put the methyl group in there and decided to make polypropylene oxide. The problem was nobody knew how to make a high molecular weight network structure out of polypropylene oxide. It didn't give high molecular weight polymer, I guess. So we had to get started on that another day. My idea was to make the low molecular weight stuff and make it branched.
Mm-hmm.
And then string it together as a polyester or polyurethane or something like that. And we did it. The student finished his PhD in June. Wasn't going to go teach until September. And so General Tire agreed to support him, and we made a bouncing rubber ball within a month of it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thought it was crazy. I said, we're going to take the polypropylene oxide at that time was known as Yukon lubricating fluid, it's liquid. So we're going to make a rubber out of that liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. And, you know, and one, a few years later, Union Carbide found out that we could make rubber out of their lubricating oils. They were flabbergasted. But you can.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we got a patent on it. And it was a very helpful patent to me. I mean, it was helpful to little bit, and I happened to move to Mobay. Got an interference with an after issue. It bought my first big racing sale. So I had, but it got us started on thinking about the problems in propylene oxide composition. Why does ethylene oxide go as a living polymer to any molecular weight? Propylene oxide will only go to 2,000 molecular weight. Well, as it turns out, it's a chain transfer process. The methyls on the hydrogen can get plucked off by base by an E2 elimination mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
You give an alkyl ion, and it starts a new chain, terminates one chain, starts a new one. So we got involved in propylene oxide. Polymerization and mechanisms of it, and about that time Herman Mark came to talk at Notre Dame, and he had learned about the Ziegler business and could talk about it long before it got published. And he also, I think, happened to know about some patented work at Dow.
Mm-hmm.
He had discovered a catalyst for propylene oxide, it gave a crystal polymer, high molecular crystal polymer. It was the discovery of propylene oxide that Ziegler's was in ethylene, propylene. A catalyst which was uniquely different from any others. Nobody knew what the crystal was, they didn't know what it was. It was a polymer.
Mm-hmm.
And because of my background in stereochemistry, it was immediately obvious to me that you had a big advantage in working on epoxide because you could make the monomer optically active.
Mm-hmm.
It was known. We made it optically active, polymerized it, and it gave a polymer with the same characteristics as the Dow stuff. Like base, even though low molecular weight had the same crystal pattern, so it proved that the catalyst had been stereoselected and made an isotactic polypropylene oxide. And
mm-hmm.
We proved it unequivocally. I mean, there wasn't any question. We made it with optically active monomer. It was optically active polymer. It had the same melting point, the same crystal structure. So, and this was just about, it was within 6 months of the time that Nada discovered the propylene. Our publications are only a few months apart at the very most. And Nada's evidence that propylene was crystalline was simply the one X-ray spacing number,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, he interpreted it as meaning it was isotactic, but it was purely a hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And he has given us credit for being the first ones to prove that a catalyst could be stereoselective and give isotactic.
Mm-hmm.
Because we proved it, he had a hypothesis that that's what it was.
Yeah.
based on the oriented fiber that gave an X-ray spacing of 525 angstroms, which fit nicely with a helical isotactic column. But I think he's right. I think we proved it in an even better way than he did. But then we went on, what's the mechanism of this isotactic polymerization? We immediately discovered that you can make a whole lot of other catalysts beside the one value. They use the ferric chloride propylene oxide reaction product. And we showed you could use almost any Lewis acid, zinc, magnesium, aluminum, alkoxide, all work to produce crystal polymer. And so it became clear that the feature was a Lewis acid alkoxide, and so we postulated that that Lewis acid was coordinating with the oxygen, which seemed reasonable. And then an alkoxide on the metal then rearranged by an internal nucleophilic replacement.
Mm-hmm.
In the complex, you have an epoxide coordinating, you have an alkoxide, this migrates over, and now that makes a new alkoxide in which you've inserted an epoxide.
Mm-hmm.
And then another epoxide can coordinate where the alkoxide group was, and then that alkoxide with the monomer unit in it can rearrange, and you have two units in. So you have a coordination rearrangement mechanism. And in almost our very first paper, when we proposed that for epoxide, we proposed it for the Ziegler. Everybody had the most weird ideas about what Ziegler was all about, surfaces and all kinds of crazy things, and we said, no, it's just a catalyst sucker. And everybody now accepts that as a mechanism. I was excited, but nobody ever credits Charles Price as having been the first one to propose that mechanism. I haven't seen anybody who ever gave me credit for that. And yet there's just no question it is the first report in the literature of that mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no evidence for it at that point except the analogy.
Yeah.
But it's there, it sits there, it gives exactly the picture that you see written in all the recent articles today.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
one never understands why that kind of thing, where why credit is given in certain instances and why not in others. We've talked about your being chairman at Notre Dame, and you were also chairman here. I suspect you approached that in much the same way as you did it. When you came here, you also feel that you had to build or revive a department? I don't know what the state of the...
No question, this department was in this one shape.
Mm-hmm.
Very much a missionary ground.
You came here as a sort of a new challenge to your...
A typical comment, it was very amusing. My friends would say, hey, I hear you're going to University of Pennsylvania. And then there'd be a small pause. Let's see, who's that pen now? That was a typical comment.
Yeah.
It had been a very inbred. Most of the PhDs teaching here had gotten their PhD with Penn. It was a very inbred and department. Nice jets, but they just had no reputation. So it was very much a building job, the physical facilities were abysmal.
Mm-hmm.
I came only because I had strong encouragement from Ralph Connor, who at that time was president of Roman Haas, was a co-author of the book with me at one time. Schreiner, Fuson, Connor, Price, and Snyder. Not the Schreiner. It was Fuson, Connor. There's an elementary book for pre-med and ag students.
Mm-hmm.
And then Snyder and I joined this co-author draft book in the second edition.
Hey, Connor had been here.
He was here.
And up until, the war?
He got involved in NDRC work in Washington.
Right.
And then after the war, he went to be the research director at Roman Haas and became president and then chairman of the board.
Yeah.
Wonderful man. A great man.
Yeah.
And a good friend. And he encouraged me strongly to come here and thought that they would be willing to help him. And they have been very helpful. Roman Haas has been very helpful.
I see.
And an awful lot of what happened here, they would never allow their name to be associated with anything.
Uh-huh.
They have built a new building, which was essential against the building.
When you came here, were you housed next door at that time, or was there something else?
There was a much older building right where this one is.
I see.
Much older building.
Mm-hmm.
that was the chemistry department, this old wreck of the building, the little wing at the back, and that. And, you know, it seemed to me the only way we could move was to get a decent lab built as quickly as we could first, to get something to move into, and then tear this old one down and build a new building here. And of course it took a little longer than I thought it was going to take to get all that done, but that's exactly what has happened. We built a new wing, which is a major lab wing, which was designed for undergraduate labs, but which was used for research until we could build this new building, and a building designed for research. That was exactly the plan I had in mind, but it took about 15 years longer than I thought it was going to take to get it done.
It always does. Then we talked a little bit about your presidency, your ACS activities. I take it the fact that you ended up as president of the ACS meant that you had always been fairly active in ACS affairs.
Yes, I had been reasonably active in ACS affairs. I had done quite a few things at the ACS before and since. And my main two accomplishments as president, well, I think, as I mentioned, I think my presidential address was very interesting to me, whether it was for anybody else or not, I don't know. And I think it was starting with both the Department of Chemistry and Public Affairs in the office and the Committee on ACS on Chemistry and Public Affairs, and very significant.
Mm-hmm. Prior to that time, the ACS had not...
scientists weren't supposed to mix up in politics.
Yep.
Since I had been active in politics, I kind of had a feeling that the fact I got elected reasonably easily was an indication that a lot of chemists thought that maybe it was time to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
So everything came together.
Yeah.
The time was right for it.
Yeah.
And I mean, my election indicated the people at the headquarters and some of the older, less liberal people that maybe this was the time.
Is that what's created problems for the ACS in terms of the IRS now? The fact that now they serve as sort of they are involved in public affairs, and as a result may no longer be a tax-exempt organization, or that had nothing to do with that?
I don't think that would be a significant part of the problem.
Yeah.
They had some pretty significant, I think the thing that was their main problem was CNEN. That was an income-producing operation.
I see.
Where they sold ads and they want income.
Mm-hmm.
And they got into trouble with that.
I see.
I don't know that.
It's a lobbying, or, well, we're really not a lobbying organization.
Really.
It's just sort of.
In any event, you're allowed 5% of your income for this, and this is a much smaller fraction of our total activity.
What about the United World Federals? You've been very active with them. And,
well, that's interesting and amusing little sidelight. I was totally apolitical animal. I hadn't been registered to vote, I guess, when I was in other name. And it was just after the war, I guess, I had to come to Washington for a couple of meetings. One with the Chemical Corps, and one with maybe several meetings. Operations after war, which was about 47, when we were just beginning to rearm, coupling back, and we started rearming. And I was feeling very blue and gloomy about the prospects that we were headed for another world war. And I came up to my family farm up in Sellersville, farming back to Indiana. My brother played me a tape recording of a congressman from Minnesota. I think his name is Judd, Congressman Judd. He'd been at their meeting and given a talk about world government. That just hit me right between the eyes. And then my good brother gave me a copy of Emory Reeves, The Anatomy of Peace. R-E-D-E-S, Emory Reeves, E-M-E-R-Y. He'd been a correspondent of the League of Nations for many years, and he realized its shortcomings, and that the only way to have an effective world organization was to have it on the basis of government. Debating society. So I read that on the way home, and it had a little tab at the bank. You turned in this tab and become a member of the United World Federalists. So by the time I got home, I was a convinced Federalist that this was the answer. You know, law and order and a peace system based on law and order was the only alternative to the war system to avoid a war.
Now, your brother and someone else in your family, I don't know, was your mother or was also involved with the United World Federation?
Yes, they were also active members. And I don't think as active as I was.
Yeah.
I immediately got active. I organized a chapter in South Bend and the state branch in Indiana. I started lobbying the state legislature.
It must have been a little hard out in conservative Midwest.
Yeah, at the beginning there was no opposition, so it wasn't that bad until people got cranked up to be opposed to the idea, and that's what led me to be a candidate for the Senate, U.S. Senate, and the House, was to try to get a voice in our government that was concerned about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting experience. But the World Federalist idea is what led me to that, and I still am absolutely convinced that that there's no alternative to war but have a peace system. And the only peace system I know that history says works is some kind of a system of law and order under government. And certainly the United Nations is not that.
Yeah.
We got around to proposing it in 1961 with the Russians to agreed principles of the Summit. It was a revolutionary document. The Russians and Zorn and the United States through McClure and Kennedy proposed, endorsed unanimously by the UN General Assembly, of two basic principles. One, that we get rid of all national military establishments, all, leaving only enough lightly armed forces for internal policing, and that the United Nations would then have to be given authority and power to settle disputes and to assure compliance, and to expect and ensure compliance with the agreement. And we proposed some treaties, the Russians proposed some treaties to implement that. And it was just totally sabotaged by the military in this country.
Well, that's what an incredible idea. That's really
And, you know, I got the military propaganda down in Washington is that we never really meant that. You know, it was just propaganda on that part.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked to Bill Foster, who was the first chairman of the committee, and I made that kind of accusation to him, you know, it's true, people in Washington say this was just propaganda, it was a new meanness, and he shook his finger at me and he said, I want you to know that John Kennedy and I were absolutely sincere, and I believe in that goal, you know, complete the same. But I would add that up until the time of the Zorn and McClure agreement, we had no problems with the military. After that, my negotiating problems were not with the Russians, they were with the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I may just point out I sabotaged it, and that's essentially the essence of an article that I just they don't even have copies here, I think. Reestablishing disarmament on the U.S. agenda, which I the global one of Cunningham in the World Affairs Council published on it, which Norman Cousins wrote a lovely editorial about it, signed and reviewed it.
If you have an extra copy of that, I have it sometime, I don't have to get it there. Was the Federation of American Scientists sort of an offshoot of this, or was
that
something else?
No, that was entirely independent. That grew out of the Federation of Atomic Scientists. We started that right before the end of World War II, to try to arouse people to the problem of nuclear weapons. And I was the chairman of that at one time, and somehow they were really clicked with that group. There were many of them who were in the arms business, and they were much more interested in what I'd call arms control than they were in really solving the war problem by general complete disarmament. And that's one of the points I've tried very vigorously to make in all the things I've written. Arms control is totally different from general complete disarmament. Arms control is part of the war game. Trying to get an advantage by limiting arms instead of building more arms. And it has some advantages. Nothing is better than not having arms control, but it has no thought, even in the faintest back of the mind, that arms control is going to get rid of the war system.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of it. And so it has a totally different objective than the GCB that was envisaged in the Zorn and McClure agreement, getting rid of all national military establishments and setting up the UN as an instrument of law and order in the world. Not easy to do, believe me, it's not easy. But it's an awful lot easier than it's going to be to put the world back together after a nuclear war. Anyhow, I can send you some things like that.
Yes, I will.